was near it, but I don't know if... Did you see anyone? Asked Professor Playfair. The wards are meant to shoot the intruder, you know, but the gears seem to have stuck after the last time. Might have still hit him, though. Did you see anyone with a limp? Anyone who looked like they were in pain? No, I didn't. I was almost to the green when the alarms went off, but I hadn't turned the corner. Was Professor Playfair nodding in sympathy? Robin hardly dared believe his luck. Was there a thief? Perhaps not. Don't you worry. Professor Playfair reached out and patted him on the shoulder. The impact set another horrible wave of pain through his whole upper body, and Robin clenched his teeth to keep from crying out. The wards get finicky sometimes. Perhaps it's time to replace them. Pity, I liked this version. Are you all right? Robin nodded and blinked, trying his hardest to keep his voice level.
Just scared, I suppose.
I mean, after what we saw last week. Ah, right. Awful, wasn't it? Nice to know that my little idea worked, though. They wouldn't even let me test it out on dogs beforehand. Good thing it wasn't you it malfunctioned on. Professor Playfair barked out a laugh. Might have pumped you full of lead.
Right, Robin said weakly. So glad.
You're fine. Have a whiskey with hot water. That'll help with the shock.
Yes, I think that sounds nice.
Robin turned to go.
Didn't you say you were on your way in?
Professor Playfair asked. Robin had this lie ready.
I was feeling anxious, so I thought I'd get a head start on a paper for Professor Lovell. But I'm a bit shaken up and I don't think I'll do any good work if I start now, so I think I'd rather just head to bed.
Of course.
Professor Playfair patted his shoulder again. It felt more forceful this time. Robin's eyes bulged.
Richard would say you're being lazy, but I quite understand. You're still only in your second year. You can afford to be lazy. Go home and sleep.
Professor Playfair gave him a last cheerful nod and strolled off towards the tower, where the alarms were still wailing. Robin took a deep breath and hobbled away, striving with all his might not to collapse on the street.
Somehow, he made it back to Magpie Lane. The bleeding still had not stopped, but after wiping his arm with a wet towel, he saw to his relief that the bullet had not lodged in his arm. It only grazed a notch into the flesh above his elbow, about a third of an inch deep. The wound looked reassuringly small when he wiped the blood away. He didn't know how to dress it properly. He imagined it might involve a needle and thread, but it would be foolish to go and seek the college nurse at this hour. He gritted his teeth against the pain, trying to remember what useful advice he'd picked up from adventure novels. Alcohol. He needed to disinfect the wound. He rummaged around his shelves until he found a half-empty bottle of brandy, a Christmas gift from Victoire. He dribbled it over his arm, hissing from the sting, then swallowed down several mouthfuls for good measure. Next, he found a clean shirt, which he ripped up to make bandages. These he wrapped tightly around his arm using his teeth. He'd read that pressure helped staunch the bleeding. He didn't know what else he ought to do. Should he simply wait now for the wound to close up on its own? His head swam. Was he dizzy from blood loss? Or was that only the brandy at work? Find Remy, he thought. Find Remy, he'll help. No. Calling on Remy would implicate him. Robin would die before he jeopardized Remy. He sat against the wall, head tilted towards the roof, and took several deep breaths. He just had to get through this night. It took several shirts. He'd have to go to the tailor, make up some story about a laundry disaster. But eventually, the bleeding was stemmed. At last, exhausted, he slumped over and fell asleep. The next day, after wincing through 3 hours of class, Robin went to the medical library and rooted through the stacks until he found a physician's handbook on field wounds. Then he went to Corn Market, bought a needle and thread, and hurried home to suture his arm back together. He lit a candle, sterilized the needle over the flame, and after many fumbled tries, managed to thread it. Then he sat down and held the sharp point above his raw, wounded flesh. He couldn't do it. He kept bringing the needle close to the wound and then, anticipating the pain, pulling it away. He reached for the brandy and took three
massive gulps. He waited several minutes until the alcohol had settled nicely in his stomach and his extremities had begun tingling pleasantly. This was where he needed to be. Dull enough not to mind the pain, alert enough to sew himself together. He tried again. It was easier this time, though he still had to stop to jam a wadded cloth in his mouth to keep from yelling. At last, he made the final stitch. His forehead dripped with sweat. Tears flowed freely down his cheeks. Somehow, he found the strength to snip the thread, tie the sutures off with his teeth, and toss the bloody needle into the sink. Then he collapsed back on his bed and, curling onto his side, finished the rest of the bottle. Griffin was not in touch that night. Robin knew it was foolish to expect he would be. Griffin, upon learning what had happened, would likely have gone underground, and for good reason. Robin wouldn't be surprised if he didn't hear from Griffin for an entire term. Still, he felt an overwhelming black wave of resentment. He told Griffin this would happen. He'd warned him. He'd told him exactly what he'd seen. This had been utterly avoidable. He wanted their next meeting to happen sooner, just so he could yell at him, say he'd told him so, that Griffin should have listened, that if Griffin weren't so arrogant, perhaps his little brother wouldn't have a line of messy stitches up his arm. But the appointment didn't come. Griffin left no notes in his window the next night or the night after. He seemed to have disappeared without a trace from Oxford, leaving Robin with no way of contacting him or Hermes at all. He couldn't talk to Griffin, couldn't confide in Victoire, Letty, or Rami. He had only himself for company that night, crying miserably over the empty bottle while his arm throbbed. And for the first time since he'd arrived at Oxford, Robin felt truly alone. Chapter 11. But slaves we are, and labour in another man's plantation. We dress the vineyard, but the wine is the owner's. John Dryden. Extract from the dedication to his translation of the Aeneid. Robin saw none of Griffin for the rest of Hilary term. Or Trinity. In truth, he hardly noticed. His second year coursework only got more difficult as the weeks went on, and he barely had time to dwell on his resentment. Summer came, though it was not a summer at all, but rather an accelerated term, and his days were occupied with frantically cramming Sanskrit vocabulary for an assessment the week before the next Michaelmas began. Then there were third-year students, a status that entailed all the exhaustion of Babel with none of its novelties. Oxford lost its charm that September. The golden sunsets and bright blue skies replaced by an endless chill and fog. It rained an inordinate amount, and the storm winds felt uniquely vicious compared to previous years. Their umbrellas kept breaking. Their socks were always wet. Rowing that term was cancelled.
2 weeks into Michaelmas, several freshers at Balliol had rented several punting boats and, in their drunken revels, created a traffic jam in the middle of the Cherwell that piled up 3 barges and 1 houseboat, costing incalculable pounds in damages. As punishment, the university had suspended all races until next year.
That was just as well. None of them had time for sports anymore. The third year at Babel was traditionally known as the Siberian winter, and the reason became obvious when they were issued their courses lists. They were all continuing in their tertiary languages and in Latin, which was rumoured to become devilishly difficult when Tacitus entered the picture. They were also continuing in translation theory with Professor Playfair and etymology with Professor Lovell, though the workload for each course had now doubled, as they were expected to produce a 5-page paper for each class every week. Most importantly, they were all assigned supervisors with whom they would pursue an independent research project. This counted as their proto-dissertation, their first piece of work that would, if completed successfully, be preserved on Babel's shelves as a true piece of scholarly contribution. Rami and Victoire were both immediately unhappy with their supervisors. Rami had been invited by Professor Joseph Harding to contribute to an editorial round of the Persian Grammatica, which was nominally a great honour.
It took a great deal of rigour and scrutiny to contribute anything to a grammatica. Oxford was still smarting from the embarrassments dealt by a former visiting lecturer named George Zalmanazar, a Frenchman who, claiming to be from Formosa, passed off his pale skin by saying that Formosans lived underground. He had lectured and published on the Formosan languages for decades before he was exposed as a complete fraud.
But Rami couldn't see the romance in such a project. Initially, I proposed the translation of Ibn Khaldun's manuscripts, he told them. The one Sylvestre de Sassy's got hold of. But Harding objected that the French Orientalists were already working on that, and that it was unlikely I could get Paris to lend them to me for the term. So then I asked if I might just translate Omar Ibn Said's Arabic essays into English, given that they'd just been sitting around for a near decade in our collections. But Harding said that was unnecessary because abolition had already passed into law in England. Can you believe it?
Omar Ibn Said was a West African Islamic scholar captured into slavery in 1807. When he wrote his autobiographical essay in 1831, he was still enslaved by American politician James Owen in North Carolina. He would remain enslaved for the rest of his life.
As if America doesn't exist. At last, Harding said if I wanted to do something authoritative, then I could edit the citations in the Persian Grammatica. So he's got me reading Schlegel now. Über die Sprache und Weisheit der Inder. And you know what? Schlegel wasn't even in India when he wrote that. He wrote it all from Paris. How do you write a definitive text on the language and wisdom of India from Paris?
This was only the beginning of the multiple flaws of Schlegel's work. Islam, he considered, a dead, empty theism. He also assumed that Egyptians were descended from Indians, and argued Chinese and Hebrew were inferior to German and Sanskrit because they lacked inflection.
Yet Rami's indignation seemed trivial compared to what Victoire was dealing with. She was working with Professor Hugo Leblanc, with whom she'd studied French for 2 years with no trouble, but who now became a source of ceaseless frustration. It's impossible, she said. I want to work on Creole, which she's not wholly opposed to, despite thinking it's a degenerate language, but all he wants to know about is voodoo. That pagan religion? Letty asked. Victoire shot her a scathing look. The religion, yes. He keeps asking about voodoo spells and poems, which he can't access, of course, because they're in Creole. Letty looked confused.
But isn't that just the same thing as French?
Not even remotely, said Victoire. French is the lexifier, yes, but Creole is its own language, with its own grammatical rules. French and Creole are not mutually intelligible. You could have studied French for a decade, but a Creole poem might still be impossible to decipher without a dictionary. Leblanc doesn't have a dictionary. There is no dictionary, not yet. So I'm the next best thing.
Then what's the problem? Asked Rami. Seems like you've got a pretty good project there.
Victoire looked uncomfortable, because the texts he wants translated are, I don't know, they're special texts, texts that mean something.
Texts are special that they shouldn't even be translated,
Letty asked. Their heritage, insisted Victoire. Their sacred beliefs. Not your beliefs, surely.
Perhaps not, said Victoire. I don't know.
But they're not meant to be shared. Would you be content to sit hour after hour with a white man as he asks you the story behind every metaphor, every god's name so he can pilfer through your people's beliefs for a match pair that might make a silver bar glow?
Letty looked unconvinced.
But it's not real, is it? Of course it's real. Oh, please, Victoire. It's real in a sense you can never know.
Victoire was growing agitated.
In a sense that only someone from Haiti could have access to. But not in the sense that Leblanc is imagining.
Letty sighed.
So why didn't you tell him just that?
You don't think I've tried? Victoire snapped. Have you ever tried to convince a Babel professor not to pursue something?
Anyhow, said Letty, annoyed and defensive now, and therefore vicious.
What would you know about voodoo? Didn't you grow up in France?
This was the worst reply she could have made. Victoire clamped her mouth shut and looked away. The conversation died. An awkward silence descended, which neither Victoire nor Letty made any attempt to break. Robin and Rami exchanged a glance, clueless, foolish. Something had gone terribly wrong. A taboo had been breached. But they were all too afraid to probe at precisely what. Robin and Letty were passably happy with their projects, plodding and time-consuming as they were. Robin was working with Professor Chakravarti to complete a list of Sanskrit loanwords to Chinese, and Letty was working with Professor Leblanc to wade through French scientific papers for possibly useful and untranslatable metaphors in the realm of mathematics and engineering. They learned to avoid discussing the details around Rami and Victoire. They all used platitudes with each other. Robin and Letty were always making good progress, while Rami and Victoire were struggling on as usual. Privately, Letty was not so generous. The subject of Professor Leblanc had become a sticking point between her and Victoire, who was hurt and astounded by Letty's lack of sympathy, while Letty thought Victoire was being too sensitive about it all. "She's brought this on herself," she complained to Robin. "She could make this so much easier if she'd just do the research. I mean, no one's done a third-year project in Haitian Creole. There's barely even a grammatica. She could be the very first." There was no debating with Letty when she was in these moods. It was obvious she only wanted an audience to vent to, but Robin tried anyway. "I suppose it means more to her than you realise."
"But it doesn't. I know it doesn't. She's not the slightest bit religious. I mean, she's civilised."
He whistled. "That's a loaded word, Letty."
"You know what I mean," she huffed. "She's not Haitian. She's French. And I just don't see why she has to be so difficult."
Halfway into Michaelmas, Letty and Victoire were hardly talking to each other. They always came to class several minutes apart, and Robin wondered if it took skill to space out their departures so that they never crossed paths on the long walk down. The girls were not the only ones suffering fractures. The atmosphere of those days was oppressive. Something had seemed to break between them all. No, break was perhaps too strong a word, for they still clung to each other with the force of people who had no one else. But their bond had twisted in a decidedly hurtful direction. They still spent nearly all their waking moments together, but they dreaded each other's company. Everything was an unintended slight or deliberate offence. If Robin complained about Sanskrit, it was insensitive to the fact that Professor Harding kept insisting Sanskrit was one of Rami's languages when it wasn't. If Rami was pleased he and Professor Harding had finally agreed on a research direction, it was a callous remark to Victoire, who had got nowhere with Professor Leblanc. They used to find solace in their solidarity, but now they saw each other only as reminders of their own misery. The worst, from Robin's perspective, was that something had changed suddenly and mysteriously between Letty and Rami. Their interactions were as heated as ever. Rami never ceased to make fun, and Letty never ceased to flare up in response. But now, Letty's rejoinders had acquired an oddly victimized tone. She snapped at the smallest, often intangible slights. Rami, in return, had got more cruel and more snide in a way that was hard to describe. Robin didn't know what to do about this, nor did he have the faintest clue what it was all about, other than that it gave him strange pangs in his chest whenever he watched these exchanges happen. "Ah, she's just being Letty," said Rami when pressed about it. "She wants attention, and she thinks throwing a tantrum is the way to get it."
"Did you do something to upset her?" Robin asked.
"Other than generally exist? I don't think so." Rami seemed bored by the subject. "Suppose we get on with this translation. Everything's all right, Birdie, I promise." But things were decidedly not all right. Things were, in fact, very weird. Rami and Letty seemed unable to stand each other, and at the same time, they gravitated around each other. They could not speak normally without fiercely opposing each other in a way that made them the protagonists of the conversation. If Rami wanted coffee, Letty wanted tea. If Rami thought that a painting on the wall was pretty, Then Letty suddenly had 12 reasons why it exemplified the worst of the Royal Academy's adherence to artistic conventionalism. Robin found it unbearable. One night, during a fitful burst of sleep, he had a sudden and violent fantasy of pushing Letty into the chairwell. When he awoke, he searched himself for any hint of guilt, but could find none. The thought of Letty drenched and sputtering brought just as much vicious satisfaction in the sober light of day. There was at least the distraction of their third-year apprenticeships, for which they would each assist a faculty member in their silverworking duties throughout the term.
Theory comes from the Greek theoria, meaning a sight or spectacle, whose root also gives us the word theatre,
so Professor Playfair expounded before he sent them off with their respective supervisors.
But it is not enough to merely watch the operations. You must get your hands dirty. You must understand how the metal sings.
In practice, this meant a lot of unpaid donkey work. To Robin's disappointment, the apprentices spent very little time on the eighth floor, where all the exciting research happened. Instead, 3 times a week he accompanied Professor Chakravarti on trips around Oxford, helping with silverwork installation and upkeep. He learned how to polish silver until it shone. Oxidation and tarnishing greatly dampened the match pair effect. How to choose between different sizes of engraving styluses to painstakingly restore an inscription to its original clarity. And how to deftly slide the bars in and out of their specially welded fixtures. It was too bad that Griffin had gone underground, he thought, for his apprenticeship gave him almost unrestricted access to the tower's tools and raw materials. He wouldn't have had to let thieves in at midnight. Amidst whole drawers of engraving equipment and absent-minded professors who wouldn't have noticed a thing, he could have plucked whatever he liked from the tower at will. "How often do you have to do this?" he asked.
"Oh, it never ends," said Professor Chakravarti. "It's how we make all our money, you see. The bars fetch a high price, but it's the upkeep that's the real grift. The workload is a bit harder on myself and Richard, though, since there are so few sinologists."
That afternoon, they were doing a house call on an estate in Wolvercote, where a silverwork installation in the back garden had ceased to function despite a 12-month warranty. They'd had some trouble getting through the front gate. The housekeeper seemed unconvinced they were Babel scholars, and rather suspicious that they were here to rob the place. But after supplying various proofs of identification, including the recitations of many Latin graces, they were at last invited in. "Happens about twice a month," Professor Chakravarti told Robin, though he looked quite put off. "You get used to it. They don't give Richard half the trouble."
Many of Babel's customers were ready to believe that their silver work made use of foreign languages, but not that their maintenance involved foreign-born scholars. And more than once, Professor Chakravarti had had to enlist one of the white fourth years to accompany him and Robin on trips just to get them through the door.
The housekeeper led them through the estate to a very lush, pretty garden with a burbling serpentine stream and several large rocks arranged at random. It was designed in the Chinese style, they were informed, which had become very popular in that era after William Chambers' Oriental landscaping designs was shown for the first time in Kew Gardens. Robin could not recall ever seeing anything like this in Canton, but he nodded along appreciatively until the housekeeper had gone.
"Well, the problem here is obvious."
Professor Chakravarti pushed some shrubbery aside to reveal the fence corner where the silverwork was installed. "They've been pushing a cart back and forth over the bar. It's rubbed the engraving half off. That's their own fault. This won't qualify under the warranty." He let Robin extract it from its fixture, then turned the bar around to show him the inscription. On one side, garden. On the other, the character Zai, which can mean a landscape garden, but more generally evoked a place for private withdrawal, to retreat from the world, with connotations of ritual purification, cleansing, almsgiving, and Taoist acts of repentance. The idea is to make their gardens nicer and quieter than the hubbub of Oxford allows. Keeps out the riffraff. The effect is quite subtle, if we're being honest. We didn't do all that much testing. But there's really no limit to what the wealthy will throw money at. Professor Chakravarti whittled at the bar as he spoke.
We'll see if that'll do the trick.
He let Robin reinstall the bar, then bent down to check his work. Satisfied, he stood and brushed his hands on his trousers.
Would you like to activate it?
I just... what, say the words? Robin had seen the professors do the same many times, though he couldn't imagine it was all that easy. Then again he recalled the waltzing bar had worked for him on the first try. Well, it's a particular kind of mental state. You do speak the words, but more importantly, you hold two meanings in your head at once. You exist in both linguistic worlds simultaneously, and you imagine traversing them. Does that make sense?
I think so, sir.
Robin frowned at the bar.
That's really all it takes.
Oh, no, I'm being careless. There are some good mental heuristics you'll learn during your fourth year, and some theory seminars you'll have to sit through, but when it comes down to it, it's about the feeling.
Professor Chakravarti seemed rather bored.
Robin got the impression he was still very irritated by this household and wanted to be away as quickly as possible. Go on.
Well, all right.
Robin placed his hand on the bar. Die. Garden. He felt a slight thrum beneath his fingertips. The garden did seem quieter then, more serene, though he couldn't tell if this was his doing or his imagination. Have we done it?
Oh, we'd better hope so.
Professor Chakravarti slung his tool bag over his shoulder. He was not concerned enough to check.
Come on, let's go and get paid.
Do you always need to speak the match pair to make it work? Robin asked as they walked back to campus. It seems untenable. That is, there are so many bars and so few translators.
Well, that depends on a number of things, said Professor Chakravarti.
To begin with, the nature of the impact. With some bars, you want a temporary manifestation. Suppose you need a short and extreme physical effect. A lot of military bars work this way. Then they need to be activated each time upon use, and they're designed so that the effects don't last long. But other bars have an enduring effect, like the wards in the tower, for example, or the bars installed in ships and carriages. What makes them last longer?
The number of carats, to start with.
Finer silver endures, and the higher the percentage of other alloys, the shorter the time of effect. But there are also subtle differences in the way they're smelted and engraved. You'll learn soon enough.
Professor Chakravarti shot him a smile.
You're eager to get started, aren't you?
It's just very exciting, sir.
That'll wear off, said Professor Chakravarti. Walk around town muttering the same words over and over again, and soon you start feeling like a parrot instead of a magician.
One afternoon, they arrived at the Ashmolean Museum to fix a silver bar that no number of incantations would activate. The English side read, verify, and the Chinese side used the character, sun, meaning to validate. It could also mean to juxtapose, to arrange side by side, and to compare things. The Ashmolean staff had been using this to compare fraudulent artifacts against the real ones. But recently, it had failed several test runs, which the staff wisely conducted before appraising new acquisitions. They carefully inspected the bar under a handheld microscope, but neither the Chinese nor the English calligraphy showed any sign of erosion. Even after Professor Chakravarti went over the whole thing with his smallest engraving stylus, it still failed to activate.
He sighed. Wrap that up and put it in my bag, won't you?
Robin obeyed.
What's wrong?
Its resonance link has stopped working. It happens sometimes, especially with some of the older match pairs.
What's a resonance link?
Off to the tower, said Professor Chakravarti, already walking away. You'll see what I mean.
Back at Babel, Professor Chakravarti led Robin up to the southern wing of the 8th floor, past the work tables. Robin had never been in this area before. All of his visits to the 8th floor had been restricted to the workshop, which occupied most of what the eye saw past the thick fire door. But another set of doors blocked off the southern wing, bolted shut with three sets of locks, which Professor Chakravarti now opened with a jangling ring of keys.
I'm really not supposed to show you just yet,
Professor Chakravarti winked at him.
Privileged information and all that. But there's no other way to explain.
He undid the final lock. They stepped through.
It was like entering a funhouse exhibit, or the inside of a giant piano.
Massive silver rods of varying heights and lengths stood upright all across the floor. Some were waist high, others towered above him, stretching from the floor to the ceiling, with just enough room between them for one to step nimbly through without touching any. They reminded Robin rather of church organs. He had a strange impulse to take a mallet and strike them all at once.
Resonance is a way of cutting costs, Professor Chakravarti explained. We need to save the higher carat silver for bars with endurance needs. The bars that go into the navy, that protect merchant ships and the like. So we use silver with a higher percentage of alloys for the bars that operate on English land, since we can keep them fueled with resonance.
Robin peered around, amazed.
But how does it all work?
It's easiest to think of Babel as the center, and all the resonance-dependent bars in England as the periphery. The periphery draws on the center for power.
Professor Chakravarti gestured around him. Each rod, Robin noticed, appeared to be vibrating at a very high frequency. But though it felt as if the tower should be ringing with discordant notes, the air was still and silent.
These rods, engraved with commonly used match pairs, sustain linked bars throughout the country. The manifesting power comes from the rod, you see, which means that the bars outside don't require such constant reactivation.
Like British outposts in the colonies, said Robin,
calling upon home for soldiers and supplies.
A convenient metaphor, yes.
So, do these resonate with every bar in England?
Robin saw in his mind an invisible network of meaning stretching over the country, keeping the silver work alive. It was quite terrifying to consider.
I'd have thought there would be more of them.
Not quite. There are much smaller resonance centres across the country. There's one in Edinburgh, for example, and one in Cambridge. The effect does weaken with distance, but the lion's share is in Oxford. It spreads the Translation Institute too far out to maintain multiple centres, as you need trained translators for the upkeep.
Robin bent to examine one of the closest rods. In addition to the match pair, written in large calligraphy at the top, he saw a series of letters and symbols that he could make no sense of.
How's the link forged, then?
It's a complicated process. Professor Chakravarti led Robin to a slender rod near the south side window. He knelt down, retrieved the Ashmolean bar from his bag, and held it up against the rod.
Robin noticed then a number of etchings in the side of the rod that corresponded with similar etchings in the bar.
They've got to be smelted from the same material. And then there's a good deal of etymological symbol work. You'll learn all of that in your fourth year if you specialize in silver working. We actually use an invented alphabet based on a manuscript first discovered by an alchemist from Prague in the 17th century.
The manuscript in question, named the Baresh Codex after the alchemist who brought it to public attention, is a vellum-bound codex of what appears to be magic, science, or botany. It is written in an alphabet combining some Latin symbols and wholly unfamiliar symbols. This alphabet employs no capitalization and no punctuation marks. The script appears closest to Latin, and indeed makes use of Latin abbreviations, but the manuscript's purpose and meaning have remained a mystery since its discovery. The manuscript was acquired by Babel in the mid-18th century, and many Babel scholars since have failed to translate it. The alphabet used for resonance links takes inspiration from the manuscript's symbols, but represents no progress in deciphering the original.
It's so that no one outside Babel can replicate our process. For now, you can think of all this adjustment as deepening the bond of connection.
But I thought fake languages didn't work to activate the bars, said Robin.
They don't to manifest meaning, said Professor Chakravarti. As a linking mechanism, however, they work quite well.
We could do with basic numbers, but Playfair likes his mysteries. Keeps things proprietary.
Robin stood a while in silence, watching as Professor Chakravarti adjusted the etchings on the Ashmolean bar with a fine stylus, examined them with a lens, and then made corresponding adjustments to the resonance rod. The whole process took about 15 minutes. At last, Professor Chakravarti wrapped the Ashmolean bar back up in velvet, returned it to his bag, and stood up.
That should do the trick. We'll head back to the museum tomorrow.
Robin had been reading the rods, noticing what a large percentage of them appear to use Chinese match pairs. You and Professor Lovell have to maintain all of these.
Yes, said Professor Chakravarti. There's no one else who can do it. Your graduation will make three.
They need us,
Robin marveled.
It was strange to think the functioning of an entire empire depended on just a handful of people.
They need us so terribly, agreed Professor Chakravarti. And it's good, in our situation, to be needed.
They stood together at the window, looking out over Oxford. Robin had the impression that the whole city was like a finely tuned music box, relying wholly on its silver gears to keep running. And that, if the silver ever ran out, if these resonance rods ever collapsed, then the whole of Oxford would stop abruptly in its tracks. The bell towers would go mute, the cabs would halt on the roads, and the townsfolk would freeze in motion on the street, limbs lifted in midair, mouths open in mid-speech. But he couldn't imagine that it would ever run out. London and Babel were getting richer every day, for the same ships fueled by long, enduring silver work brought back chests and chests of silver in return. There wasn't a market on earth that could resist British incursion, not even the Far East. The only thing that would disrupt the inflow of silver was the collapse of the entire global economy. And since that was ridiculous, the Silver City and the delights of Oxford seemed eternal. One day in mid-January, they showed up at the tower to find all the upperclassmen and graduate fellows wearing black under their gowns.
It's for Anthony Ribbon, explained Professor Playfair when they filed into his seminar.
He himself was wearing a shirt of lilac blue.
What about Anthony? Letty asked.
I see. Professor Playfair's face tightened. They haven't told you.
Told us what?
Anthony went missing during a research expedition to Barbados last summer, said Professor Playfair. He disappeared the night before his ship was due to return to Bristol, and we haven't heard from him since. We're presuming he's dead. His colleagues on the 8th floor are quite upset. I believe they'll be wearing black for the rest of the week. A few of the other cohorts and fellows have joined in, if you care to participate.
He said this with such casual unconcern that they might have been discussing whether they wanted to go punting that afternoon. Robin gaped at him.
But isn't he... Aren't you... I mean, doesn't he have family? Have they been told?
Professor Playfair scribbled an outline for that day's lecture on the chalkboard as he answered.
Anthony has no family except his guardian. Mr. Falwell's been notified by post, and I hear he's quite upset.
My God, said Letty. That's terrible.
She said this with a solicitous glance at Victoire, who among them had known Anthony the best. But Victoire looked surprisingly unfazed. She didn't seem shocked or upset, so much as vaguely uncomfortable. Indeed, she looked as if she hoped they might change topics as quickly as possible. Professor Playfair was more than happy to oblige.
Well, on to business, he said. We left off last Friday on the innovations of the German Romantics.
Babel did not mourn Anthony. The faculty did not so much as hold a memorial service. The next time Robin went up to the silver working floor, a wheat-haired graduate fellow he didn't know had taken over Anthony's workstation.
It's disgusting, Letty said. Can you believe? I mean, a Babel graduate, and they just act like he was never here.
Her distress belied a deeper terror, a terror which Robin felt as well, which was that Anthony had been expendable, that they were all expendable, that this tower, this place where they had for the first time found belonging, treasured and loved them when they were alive and useful, but didn't, in fact, care about them at all. That they were, in the end, only vessels for the languages they spoke.
No one said that out loud. It came too close to breaking the spell. Of them all, Robin had assumed Victoire would be most devastated. She and Anthony had grown quite close over the years. There were two of only a handful of black scholars in the tower, and they were both born in the West Indies. Occasionally he'd seen them talking, heads bent together, as they walked from the tower to the buttery. But he never once saw her cry that winter. He wanted to comfort her, but he did not know how, especially as it seemed impossible to broach the topic with her.
Whenever Antony was brought up, she flinched, blinked rapidly, and then tried very hard to change the subject. "Did you know Antony was a slave?" Letty asked one night in hall. Unlike Victoire, she was determined to raise the issue at every opportunity. Indeed, she was obsessed with Antony's death in a way that felt uncomfortably, performatively righteous. Or would have been. His master didn't want him freed when abolition took effect, so he was going to take him to America. And he only got to stay at Oxford because Babel paid for his freedom. Paid! Can you believe it? Robin glanced at Victoire, but her face had not changed one bit. "Letty," she said very calmly, "I'm trying to eat."
Chapter 12. In a word, I was too cowardly to do what I knew to be right, as I had been too cowardly to avoid doing what I knew to be wrong. Charles Dickens, Great Expectations. They were well into Hillary term before Griffin resurfaced. So many months had passed by then that Robin had stopped checking his window with his usual rigour, and he would have missed the note if he had not spotted a magpie trying in vain to retrieve it from under the pane. The note instructed Robin to show up at the Twisted Root at 2:30 the next day, but Griffin was nearly an hour late. When he did arrive, Robin was astounded by his haggard appearance. The sheer act of walking through the pub seemed to exhaust him. By the time he sat down, he was breathing as hard as if he'd just run the length of Parks. He'd clearly not had a change of clothes in days. His smell wafted, attracting glares. He moved with a slight limp, and Robin glimpsed bandages under his shirt every time he raised his arm. Robin was not sure what to do with this. He'd had a rant prepared for this meeting, but the words died at the sight of his brother's obvious misery. Instead, he sat silently as Griffin ordered shepherd's pie and 2 glasses of ale.
"Term going all right?" Griffin asked.
"It's fine," said Robin. I'm working on an independent project now."
"With whom?"
Robin scratched at his shirt corner. He felt stupid bringing it up at all. "Chakravarti."
"That's nice."
The ale arrived. Griffin drained his glass, set it down and winced.
"That's lovely."
"The rest of my cohort's not too happy with their assignments, though."
"Of course they aren't," Griffin snorted. "Babel's never going to let you do the research you ought to be doing, only the research that fills the coffers."
A long silence passed. Robin felt vaguely guilty, though he had no good reason to be. Still, a worm of discomfort ate further into his gut with every passing second. Food came. The plate was steaming hot, but Griffin wolfed his down like a man starved. And he just might have been too. When he bent over his place, his collarbones protruded in a way that hurt to look at.
"Say," Robin cleared his throat, unsure how to ask, "Griffin, is everything—"
"Sorry." Griffin put his fork down. I only got back to Oxford last night, and I'm exhausted."
Robin sighed.
"Sure. Anyhow, here's a list of texts I need from the library."
Griffin reached into his front pocket and pulled out a crumpled note.
"You might have some trouble finding the Arabic volumes. I've transliterated the titles for you, which will get you to the right shelf, but then you'll have to identify them on your own. But they're in Bodleian, not the Tower, so you won't have to worry about someone wondering what you're up to."
Robin took the note. "That's it?"
"That's it."
"Really?" Robin couldn't suppress it anymore. He expected callousness from Griffin, but not this blank pretense of ignorance. His sympathy evaporated, along with his patience. Now the resentment, which he'd kept simmering for a year, rushed to the fore.
"You're sure?"
Griffin cast him a wary look.
"What's the matter?"
"We're not going to talk about last time," Robin demanded.
"Last time?"
"When the alarm went off. We sprang a trap. We sprang a gun."
"You were fine."
"I was shot," Robin hissed. "What happened? Someone messed up, and I know it wasn't me because I was right where I was supposed to be, meaning you were wrong about the alarms."
"These things happen," Griffin shrugged. "The good thing is that no one got caught."
"I was shot in the arm."
"So I heard."
Griffin peered over the table as if he could see Robin's wound through his shirt sleeve.
"It seemed quite all right, though."
I had to stitch myself together.
Well done, you. Smarter than going to the college nurse. You didn't, did you?
What is wrong with you?
Keep your voice down, said Griffin.
Keep my...
I don't see why we're labouring the point. I made a mistake. You got away. It won't happen again. We're going to stop sending people in with you. Instead, you'll drop off the contraband outside on your own.
That's not the point,
Robin hissed once more.
You let me get hurt. Then you left me out in the cold.
Please, don't be so dramatic, Griffin sighed. Accidents happen, and you're fine. He paused, considering, and then said more quietly, Look, if this will make you feel better, there's a safe house on St. Aldert's we use when we need to hide out for a bit. There's a basement door by the church. It looks rusted shut, but you've only got to look for where the bar's installed and say the words. It leads to a tunnel end that got overlooked when they did the renovations. Robin shook his arm at Griffin.
A safe house doesn't fix this.
We'll be better next time, Griffin insisted. It was a slip-up, that was my fault. We're adjusting for it, so calm down before someone overhears. He settled back in his chair. Now, I've been out of town for months, so I need to hear what's been going on at the tower, and I'd like you to be efficient about it, please.
Robin could have hit him then.
He would have, if it would not have attracted stares, if Griffin were not so clearly already in pain. He was getting nothing out of his brother, he knew. Griffin, like Professor Lovell, could be astonishingly single-minded. If something did not suit them, they simply failed to acknowledge it. And indeed, any attempt to procure acknowledgement would only end in more frustration. He had the fleeting impulse simply to stand up and walk away, if only to see Griffin's expression. But that would grant no lasting satisfaction. If he turned back around, Griffin would mock him. If he kept walking out, he would only have severed his own ties to Hermes. So he did what he did best, with father and brother both. He swallowed his frustrations and resigned himself to letting Griffin set the terms of the conversation. Not much, he said after a calming breath. The professors haven't been travelling abroad recently, and I don't think the wards have changed since last time either. Oh, something terrible happened. A graduate fellow, Anthony Ribbon.
Sure, I know Anthony,
Griffin said, then cleared his throat.
New, I mean.
Same cohort.
So you've heard?
Robin asked.
Heard what? That he's dead.
What?
No.
Griffin's voice was oddly flat.
No, I just meant I knew him before I left.
He's dead. Lost at sea, sailing back from the West Indies, apparently, said Robin.
Terrible,
Griffin said blandly. Just awful.
That's all?
Robin asked. What do you want me to say?
He was your classmate.
I hate to tell you, but these incidents aren't uncommon. Voyages are dangerous. Someone goes missing every few years.
But it's just... it feels wrong. That they won't even give him a memorial. They're just carrying on like it never happened. It's...
Robin trailed off. Suddenly, he wanted to cry. He felt foolish for bringing this up.
He didn't know what he had wanted. Some kind of validation, perhaps. That Anthony's life had mattered, and that he could not be so easily forgotten.
But Griffin, he should have known, was the worst person from whom to seek comfort.
Griffin was silent for a long time. He stared out of the window, brows furrowed in concentration, as if he were pondering something. He didn't seem to be listening to Robin at all. Then he cocked his head, opened his mouth, closed it, then opened it again.
You know, that's not a surprise, the way Babel treats its students, particularly those they recruit from abroad. You're an asset to them, that's all you are. A translation machine. And once you've failed them, you're out.
But he didn't fail, he died.
Same thing.
Griffin stood up and grabbed his coat.
Anyhow, I want those texts within the week. I'll leave you instructions on where to drop them.
We're done?
Robin asked, startled. He felt a fresh wave of disappointment. He didn't know what he wanted from Griffin, or indeed if Griffin was capable of giving it, but still, he'd hoped for more than this.
I've places to be, Griffin said without turning around.
He was already on his way out.
Watch your window.
It was, by every measure, a very bad year. Something had poisoned Oxford, had sucked out everything about the university that gave Robin joy. The nights felt colder, the rains heavier. The tower no longer felt like a paradise, but a prison. Coursework was torture. He and his friends took no pleasure in their studies. They felt neither the thrilling discovery of their first year, nor the satisfaction of actually working with silver that might one day come with their fourth. The older cohorts assured them that this always happened, that the third year slump was normal and inevitable. But that year seemed a markedly bad year in several other respects. For one, the number of assaults on the tower rose alarmingly. Before, Babel could expect 2 to 3 attempted break-ins per year, all of which were the subject of great spectacle, as the students crowded around the doors to see what cruel effect Playfair's wards had wrought that time. But by February of that year, the attempted thefts started happening nearly every week, and the students began to grow sick of the sight of policemen dragging maimed perpetrators down the cobblestones. They weren't only targeted by thieves. The base of the tower was constantly being defiled, usually with urine, broken bottles, and spilt booze. Twice, they discovered graffiti painted overnight in large, crooked scarlet letters. "Tongues of Satan," read the one on the back wall. "Devil Silver," read the one beneath the first floor window. Another morning, Robin and his cohort arrived to find dozens of townsmen assembled on the green, shouting viciously at the scholars going in and out of the front door. They approached cautiously. The crowd was a bit frightening, but not so dense that they couldn't weave their way through. Perhaps it said something that they were willing to risk a mob rather than miss class. But it really looked like they might get by without harassment, until a large man stepped in front of Victoire and began snarling something in a rough and incomprehensible northern accent.
"I don't know you," Victoire gasped. "I don't know what you're..." "Christ!"
Rami lurched forward like he'd been shot. Victoire yelped. Robin's heart stopped. But it was only an egg, he saw. It was aimed at Victoire, and Rami had lurched because he'd stepped forward to protect her. Victoire flinched back, arms shielding her face. Rami put an arm around her shoulder and ushered her up the front steps.
"What is wrong with you?" Letty screamed.
The man who'd thrown the egg shouted something unintelligible in return. Hastily, Robin clenched Letty's hand and dragged her through the door behind Rami and Victoire.
"Are you all right?" he asked.
Victoire was trembling so hard she could barely speak.
"Fine. I'm fine. Oh, Rami, let me. I've got a handkerchief."
"Don't worry." Rami shrugged off his jacket. "It's a lost cause. I'll buy a new one." Inside the lobby, students and clients alike were clustered at the wall, watching the crowd through the windows. Robin's first instinct was to wonder if this was the work of Hermes. But it couldn't be. Griffin's thefts were so meticulously planned. They belied a far more sophisticated apparatus than this furious mob.
"Do you know what's going on?" Robin asked Cathy O'Neill.
"They're mill workers, I think," said Cathy. "I heard Babel's just signed a contract with mill owners north of here, and that's put all these people out of work."
"All these people?" Remy asked. "With just some silver bars?"
"Oh, they've laid off several hundred workers," said Vimal, who'd overheard. "Supposedly, it's a brilliant match pair. Something Professor Playfair came up with. And it's netted us enough to fund renovations for the entire east wing of the lobby. Which doesn't surprise me if it can do the work of all those men combined."
"But it's quite sad, isn't it?"
mused Cathy. "I wonder what they'll do now."
"What do you mean?"
asked Robin. Cathy gestured to the window.
"Well, how are they going to provide for their families?"
It shamed Robin that he hadn't even considered this. Upstairs in their etymology class, Professor Lovell expressed a decidedly more cruel opinion.
"Don't worry about them. Just the usual riffraff. Drunkards, malcontents from up north, lowlifes with no better way to express their opinions than shouting about them on the street. I'd prefer they wrote a letter, of course, but I doubt half of them can read.
Is it true they're out of work?
Asked Victoire.
Well, of course. The sort of labour they do is redundant now. It should have been made redundant long ago. There's simply no reason that weaving, spinning, carding or roving hasn't all been mechanised already. This is simply human progress.
They seem rather cross about it, Rami observed.
Oh, they're furious for sure, said Professor Lovell. You can imagine why. What has silverworking done for this country over the past decade? Increased agricultural and industrial productivity to an unimaginable extent. It's made factories so efficient they can run with a quarter of their workers. Take the textile industry. Kay's Flying Shuttle, Arkwright's Water Frame, Crompton's Spinning Mule, and Cartwright's Loom were all made possible with silverworking. Silverworking has catapulted Britain ahead of every other nation and put thousands of labourers out of work in the process. So instead of using their wits to learn a skill that might actually be useful, they've decided to whine about it on our front steps.
Those protests outside aren't anything new, you know.
There's a sickness in this country.
Professor Lovell spoke now with a sudden, nasty vehemence. It started with the Luddites. Some idiot workers in Nottingham who thought they'd rather smash machinery than adapt to progress. And it's spread across England since. There are people all over the country who'd rather see us dead. It's not just Babel that gets attacked like this. No, we don't even see the worst of it. Since our security's better than most. Up north, those men are pulling off arson. They're stoning building owners. They're throwing acid on factory managers. They can't seem to stop smashing looms in Lancashire. No, this isn't the first time our faculty have received death threats. It's only the first time they've dared to come as far south as Oxford.
Do you get death threats?
Letty asked, alarmed.
Of course. I get more and more every year.
But doesn't it bother you?
Professor Lovell scoffed.
Never. I look at those men and I think of the vast differences between us. I am where I am because I believe in knowledge and scientific progress, and I have used them to my advantage. They are where they are because they have stubbornly refused to move forward with the future. Men like that don't scare me. Men like that make me laugh.
Is it going to be like this all year?
Victoire asked in a small voice.
Out on the green, I mean.
Not for long, Professor Lovell assured her. No, they'll have cleared off by this evening. Those men have no persistence. They'll be gone by sunset once they get hungry, or once they wander off in search of a drink. And if they don't, the wards and the police will move them on.
But Professor Lovell was wrong. This wasn't the work of an isolated handful of discontents, nor did they simply dissipate overnight. The police did clear the crowd away that morning, but they returned in smaller numbers. Several times a week, a dozen or so men showed up to harass scholars on their way into the tower. One morning, the entire building had to be evacuated when a package making a ticking noise was delivered to Professor Playfair's office. It turned out to be a clock connected to an explosive. Fortunately, rain had soaked through the package, eroding the fuse.
But what happens when it doesn't rain? Rami asked.
No one had a good answer to that. Security at the tower doubled overnight. The post was now received and sorted by newly hired clerks at a processing centre halfway across Oxford. A rotating team of policemen guarded the tower entrance at all hours. Professor Playfair installed a new set of silver bars over the front door, though, as usual, he refused to reveal what match pairs he'd inscribed them with, or what they would do when triggered. These protests were not the symptoms of a minor disturbance. Something was happening throughout England, a set of changes the consequences of which they were only beginning to fathom. Oxford, which consistently ran about a century behind the rest of England's major cities, could only pretend to be immune to change for so long. The vicissitudes of the world outside had now become impossible to ignore. This was about more than mill workers. Reform, unrest, and inequality were the key words of the decade. The full impact of a so-called silver industrial revolution, a term coined by Peter Gaskell just 6 years before, was just beginning to be felt across the country. Silver-powered machines of the kind William Blake dubbed dark, satanic mills were rapidly replacing artisanal labor, but rather than bringing prosperity to all, they had instead created an economic recession, had caused a widening gap between the rich and poor that would soon become the stuff of novels by Disraeli and Dickens. Rural agriculture was in decline. Men, women, and children moved en masse to urban centers to work in factories, where they labored unimaginably long hours and lost limbs and lives in frightful accidents. The new Poor Law of 1834, which had been designed to reduce the costs of poverty relief more than anything else, was fundamentally cruel and punitive in design. It withheld financial aid unless applicants moved into a workhouse, and those workhouses were designed to be so miserable no one would want to live in them. Professor Lovell's promised future of progress and enlightenment seemed only to have brought poverty and suffering. The new jobs he thought the displaced workers should take up never materialized. Truly, the only ones who seemed to profit from the silver industrial revolution were those who were already rich, and the select few others who were cunning or lucky enough to make themselves so. These currents were unsustainable. The gears of history were turning fast in England. The world was getting smaller, more mechanized and more unequal, and it was as yet unclear where things would end up, or what that would mean for Babel, or for the empire itself. Robin and his cohort, though, did what scholars always did, which was to bend their heads over their books and focus solely on their research. The protesters eventually dispersed after troops sent in from London dragged the ringleaders off to Newgate. The scholars stopped holding their breath every time they ascended the steps to the tower. They learned to put up with the swarming police presence, along with the fact that now it took twice as long for new books and correspondence to arrive. They stopped reading the editorials in the Oxford Chronicle, which was a newly minted pro-reform, pro-radical publication that seemed intent on destroying their reputation. Still, they couldn't quite ignore the headlines hawked from every street corner on their way to the tower. Babel a threat to the national economy? Foreign bars send dozens to the workhouse. Say no to silver. It should have been distressing. In truth, though, Robin found it was actually quite easy to put up with any degree of social unrest as long as one got used to looking away. One stormy night, on his way to dinner at Professor Lovell's home, Robin glimpsed a family sitting at the corner of Woodstock Road, holding out tin mugs for alms. Beggars were a common sight in Oxford's outskirts, but entire families were rare. The two small children gave him little waves as he approached, and the sight of their pale, rain-streaked faces made him feel guilty enough to stop and fish several pennies out of his pocket.
"Thank you," murmured the father. "God bless you."
The man's beard had grown out, and his clothes had got a good deal tattier, but Robin still recognized him. He was, without question, one of the men who had screamed obscenities at him on his way into the tower several weeks ago. He met Robin's eyes. It wasn't clear if he recognized Robin as well. He opened his mouth to say something, but Robin quickened his pace, and whatever the man might have called after him was soon drowned out by the wind and the rain. He didn't mention the family to Mrs. Piper or Professor Lovell. He didn't want to dwell on all the things they represented. The fact that, for all of his professed allegiance to revolution, for his commitment to equality and to helping those who were without, he had no experience of true poverty at all. He'd seen hard times in Canton, but he had never not known where his next meal might come from, or where he would sleep at night. He had never looked at his family and wondered what it might take to keep them alive. For all his identification with the poor orphan Oliver Twist, for all his bitter self-pity, the fact remained that since the day he had set foot in England, he had not once gone to sleep hungry. At night, he ate his dinner, smiled at Mrs. Piper's compliments, and shared a bottle of wine with Professor Lovell. He walked a different route back to the college. The next month, he forgot to take the same detour on his way up, but it didn't matter. By then, the little family was already gone. Looming exams made a bad year awful. Babel scholars underwent two rounds of exams, one at the end of their third year and another during their fourth. These were staggered throughout the calendar. The fourth years sat their exams in the middle of Hillary term. while the third years had until Trinity term. The effect was that starting after the winter holidays, the mood in the tower was utterly changed. The libraries and study rooms were packed during all hours by nervous fourth years, who flinched whenever someone breathed and looked ready to murder whenever someone dared to so much as whisper. Traditionally, Babel publicly announced the fourth year's marks at the end of the examination period. At noon on Friday of that week, a bell rang three times throughout the tower. Everyone stood and hurried downstairs to the lobby, where that afternoon's clients were being ushered out the door. Professor Playfair stood on